You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
The U.S. men's basketball team, an 8-point lead at halftime over France. This is going to be their toughest game of their three scheduled preliminary games. They will also face Iran and the Czech Republic. So if the U.S., and they've had a very, very rocky preseason camp, three of their 11 active players just arrived in Tokyo a day or two ago after playing in the NBA Finals up until last week. But an 8-point lead at halftime for Team USA as they look to get themselves on solid footing looking ahead to the rest of this Olympic men's basketball tournament as they look for their fourth consecutive gold medal. I mean, look, you trace the history of U.S. basketball going back to 1992 with the original Dream Team. 92, utterly dominant. I mean, it was one of the most spectacular things we've ever seen. 96, still pretty dominant, but not as much. 2000, the rest of the world started to catch up, and then it cratered in 2004 when the U.S. had to settle for the bronze medal in Athens after losing in the semifinals to Argentina. And then, of course, that led to the Redeem Team, Mike Krzyzewski taking over the program, Jerry Colangelo taking over the program, and the Kobe Bryant, LeBron James team leading the way to gold in 2008. The 2012 team was spectacular, another gold medal in 2016, but this is not going to be easy. And for a certain generation of American basketball fans, the gold medal is the clear expectation for the United States. And it's still the expectation this season, but trust me when I tell you, it's not going to be easy, evidenced by an 8-point halftime lead right now over France. So we'll keep you updated on that. And case in point, how tenuous this lead is. France is 1-for-11 from downtown. You go 4-for-11 in the first half, and you've got a 1-point lead over the Americans. So we'll continue to follow along. Second half coming up, USA leading 45-37. By the way, this the Anita Marks show on 98.7 ESPN is brought to you by PGA Tour Superstores. Shop with the pros at your New York or New Jersey area PGA Tour Superstores, the home for golf pros and beginners. Number to call is always 1-800-919-3776, 1-800-919-ESPN. Got Ty Butler producing for us this morning. The Yankees yesterday, the biggest win of the season. Now, is it too little, too late? Is it going to lead to a resurgence in the second half of the season? I don't know. All I do know is this. I know that the Yankees had been playing much better leading into Thursday night's game at Fenway Park. I do know that if Chad Green was able to get Kike Hernandez out in the ninth inning with two outs and close out that game on Thursday, the Yankees would have been 10-3 in their last 13 games at that point, with Gerrit Cole coming up on the mound the next day. But everything fell apart that Thursday night in Fenway. And then Gerrit Cole did not give the Yankees what they needed on Friday. The Yankees ace needed to give them more on Friday when he took the ball in game two of that series. He was not up for the challenge, as he has not been several times in situations like that as the ace of the Yankee staff. But what yesterday's game did, and you're following along, and I was actually on the air here yesterday afternoon from 3 to 6:30, right in the middle of the game. In fact, just as I signed off at 6:30, the Yankees had taken a 4-3 lead with that four-run eighth inning that literally came out of nowhere. I mean, literally came out of nowhere, because you've got guys in this Yankees lineup right now. I mean, Brett Gardner's your number two hitter, and he's batting 192. Chris Gittens, I'm sorry, really good minor league hitter. He's not a major league baseball player. He's batting 118. You have Greg Allen in the starting lineup, who's been a really, really nice spark since joining the roster and has really given the Yankees a jolt of energy and athleticism, something they have desperately needed, he and Estevan Florial. But with all due respect to Greg Allen and what he's doing, he's a 28-year-old journeyman. So you wonder, is this just a hot streak for a guy who's just come up from the minors and is contributing, or does this have staying power? You question that less with Florial, because he's been one of the top prospects in the Yankees minor league system for years. And then you've got this minor league catcher named Rob Brantley, who's starting because Gary Sanchez has back spasms and Kyle Higashioka is still on the COVID-19 list. So basically the Yankees yesterday roll out a starting lineup with at best six major league hitters in it and still somehow find a way to beat the first-place Red Sox. And it was not trending in that direction because it looked like a typical lifeless, listless afternoon for the Yankees lineup. Jameson Taillon gave up single runs in the first, the second, and the third innings. But then he held them at that, and he allowed at least the Yankees a chance to think they were still in the game. But the offense throughout the game gave you absolutely no indication that they were going to make a run in this game. And then all of a sudden, the eighth inning comes out of nowhere, and this is what makes this game so satisfying for the Yankees fan, because there have been so few of these performances this season. And it starts with Florial, and you really like what he's given. And I said this yesterday, I'll continue to repeat myself, seeing guys like Esteban Florial and Greg Allen wearing the Yankee uniform, guys who are athletic, guys who are fast, guys who can take an extra base, it's really jarring compared to what we're used to seeing in the Yankee uniform. I mean, I think of the Yankee uniform right now, I think of Giancarlo Stanton, who is so muscular that I don't even know if he could bend over and touch his toes. So seeing these guys come up and just add a completely different dimension to the Yankees lineup has been really refreshing. And Florial started it off with a double in that eighth inning. But after Brantley pops out and LeMahieu flies out, you've got two outs and nobody on. One man on second base, and it's 3-0. And then the floodgates open, and Brett Gardner comes up with the big two-out single to right field to score Florial. Again, his speed allowing him to score on a single from second base. And there used to be a time, and for many teams, there still is a time, where that's a given. Second base is scoring position, right? Well, not on these Yankees. The Yankees are the definition of a station-to-station-to-station team. So to have a guy like Florial be able to score easily from second base on a single to right field, as crazy as it sounds, is no small feat. And here's what you love about the Yankee rally. Florial double, then the two outs. Gardner single, and then they bring in Adam Ottavino to replace Nathan Eovaldi. And then Stanton, for the second time in this series, comes up with a big late hit, a ground rule double to right field to send Gardner to third. Tough break for the Yankees, because with Gardner running from first base, you figure if Stanton's ball remains in the field of play, Gardner's going to be able to score from first. Instead, because it was a ground rule double, he goes back to third base. So you've got second and third, you've got two outs, and you're thinking, oh, it's our luck again. The ball going out of play, the ground rule double forcing Brett Gardner back to third base. But then Rougned Odor comes up with a huge double to left center field, scoring Gardner and Tyler Wade to tie the game at 3. And then Gleyber Torres, who's been excellent since the All-Star break, with a single to right field with the ultimate game-winning run, scoring Rougned Odor. And then Aroldis Chapman, of course, made things interesting in the ninth after Jonathan Loaisiga made things a little interesting in the eighth inning. But the Yankees come away with a huge, huge 4-3 victory. And yes, you could say it's the biggest win of the season, but it's only the biggest win of the season if they win this game today. Because you've got to come out of this four-game series with a split. Think of the four games so far. You had a 3-1 lead with two outs in the ninth inning on Thursday night. You lose that game. You have your ace on the mound on Friday in a game in which the Red Sox starter leaves after one inning, so they need eight innings out of their bullpen, and you lose that game. And then yesterday, you come back to win. So they should have easily gotten at least a split of this series. They have today to try to do that with Domingo Germán on the mound. But here's what you love the most about the rally in the eighth inning. Double, single, double, double, single. What didn't I say there? What did I not say there? I did not say the words home run. And home runs are nice and home runs are great. But right now, you've got a lineup of guys who don't rely on the home run. They aren't prolific home run hitters. Florial is not a prolific home run hitter. Gardner, at this point in his career, is not a prolific home run hitter. Even Stanton wasn't all or nothing yesterday. It wasn't a home run or a strikeout. It was a ground rule double to right field. And Stanton, like I said, has two big hits in this series so far. So you'll even the two outs that almost killed the rally, Brantley and LeMahieu, they didn't strike out. No strikeouts in the inning for the Yankees. How amazing is that? How often do you see that this season where the Yankees get through an entire inning without striking out? These guys lately, okay, have put the bat on the ball. They've had to change the way they play. Now, is it going to lead to sustained success? It's hard to say with the talent right now that they're putting in the lineup. You know, you're going to get Judge back. You're going to get Gio Urshela back. You hope to get Luke Voit back at some point. You hope to get Gary Sanchez back sooner rather than later. But for now, these guys have been very refreshing. So where are the Yankees right now? Well, they haven't lost a series in almost a month. The last series they lost was the Subway Series against the Mets on July 3rd and July 4th, when they lost the first two games of that series and then salvaged it with the second game of a doubleheader on the 4th of July. Starting with that game, the Yankees are now 10-5 since the finale of that Mets series on July 4th, with series wins in Seattle, in Houston, at home against the Red Sox, at home against the Phillies, and now a chance for a four-game split in Fenway Park against the Red Sox. So the Yankees have played much better of late. They're now 3.5 games out of the second wild card spot against the Oakland A's. So for everything, and it feels like, and I was talking to Ty, our producer, before the show, every single show I've done lately, and I've done a bunch during the summer, every single show I've done lately, it's been pessimism, pessimism, pessimism regarding the Yankees, including yesterday. I mean, yesterday's show's hilarious because it's from 3 to 6:30, and from 3 to 6:15, I'm on telling everybody the obituary of the Yankee season. This is who they are, day late and a dollar short. Things are just not adding up for this Yankees team this year. It's not going to happen for this Yankees team. And then all of a sudden, the last 15 minutes of my show, they score four runs in the top of the eighth inning out of nowhere. Guys like Florial and Gardner and Odor coming up with the big hits in that rally. And they win the game 4-3. So does it completely change your perspective on this team? No. But what you need to do is you need to keep not losing series. And again, they haven't lost a series since the first weekend of July. You need to keep not losing series, which makes today's game a very big game. And then you move on. You have a day off tomorrow. And then a big three-game series at Tampa Bay. And that takes you right up to the trade deadline. And what are the Yankees going to do at the trade deadline? Look, the Yankees are such an interesting case because they're a team that, if they can figure out a way to get to the postseason, could succeed in the postseason. I do truly believe that because there's a path, as frustrating as the Yankees have been, there's a path for them to succeed in the postseason. In any postseason series you play, you're likely going to have the best pitcher in that series in Gerrit Cole. The Yankee season took its first significant downturn, in my opinion, when Corey Kluber went out with an injury the start after his no-hitter. He's expected to come back at some point. Before he got hurt, culminating with the no-hitter against Texas, Corey Kluber had turned into the bona fide number two starter who the Yankees were hoping he'd be. Jordan Montgomery's been solid this year. If Jordan Montgomery, the way he has pitched this year, is your number four starter, you are extremely happy. And don't look now, but Jameson Taillon's numbers in July are not good. They're excellent. In four starts in July, including yesterday, in which he gave up those three early runs and then held the Red Sox right there to give the Yankees a chance to get back in the game, and he actually hung around long enough to pick up the win in the game. In Taillon's four July starts, he's 3-0. With a 1.43 ERA and 20 strikeouts in 25 and a third innings. His ERA during July has dropped from 5.43 to 4.36. So there are signs of life for the Yankees on both sides, the pitching and the hitting side. Taillon, the most notable example on the pitching side, he and Jordan Montgomery have been very good. And on the hitting side, finally, after waiting all of 2020 and the first half of 2021, you are starting to see Gleyber Torres play like he did his first two seasons with the Yankees, when he was an all-star in each of his first two major league seasons. Now, is he tearing the cover off the ball yet? No, but there are some excellent signs, and his numbers after the all-star break are in stark contrast to his numbers before the all-star break. Look at this. Before the All-Star break, Torres was batting .240 with three home runs and 29 RBIs in 77 games. Since the All-Star break, he's hitting .269. He's got three home runs. He's got seven runs batted in eight games. Those numbers are much more in line with the player who Gleyber Torres was each of his first two seasons. He's on a 7-game hitting streak during which he's batting .318 with 3 homers and 7 RBIs. And it's not all or nothing, evidenced by the game-winning single to right field that scored Rougned Odor with the eventual game-winning run in their 4-3 win yesterday.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Yankees' biggest win of the season? I think so, but it's got to lead to something more before you can definitively say it was so. But it could be a turning point. And right now, all it's done, it has wiped out the stain from Thursday night's win when they were one out away from really an impressive victory at Fenway Park to begin this 4-game series. The Yankees lost on Thursday, and the Yankees come from behind win on Saturday, in my mind, cancel each other out. Disappointing performance for Gerrit Cole in the middle of those two games on Friday. So the Yankees need this one today. This is a huge game today before the off day tomorrow and heading into the 3-game series at Tampa Bay, which will bring them right up to the trade deadline. You've got Domingo Herman, 4-5, 4.71 against Martin Perez, 7-6, 4.16 ERA. You hope to have Gary Sanchez back in the starting lineup today. Before yesterday's game, Boone said he was hopeful that Sanchez could return for today from the back spasms. I mean, let's be honest, especially with Kyle Higashioka out right now, some of these guys the Yankees are playing. I mean, this Rob Brantley guy, I mean, God forgive me, but he's not a Major League Baseball player. And I said this yesterday, Brooks Kreske with his 4 wild pitches on Thursday night was the headliner. I think an average Major League catcher either catches or blocks 3 of those 4 pitches. Chris Gittens is not a Major League Baseball player. He's, a 4A player. Puts up really, really, really good numbers in AAA. But I've seen enough of Chris Gittens to know that he's not a Major League Baseball player. But look, this is the hand they have been dealt right now. Sanchez is injured. Higashioka's on the COVID list. Judge is on the COVID list. Urshela is on the COVID list. Voit is injured. Aaron Hicks is injured. We know that. So their goal right now is to hold it together. You're 3.5 games behind the A's for the second wild card spot. You're a game behind the Mariners, the only team in between the Yankees and the Athletics. So you're right into it. You're right in it. I mean, here's the thing. It's funny because all season long, the Mets have been this great story. And the Mets are not a team without high expectations this season. There were high expectations for the Mets. I mean, they were pretty good last year. They were not as good as they were better than their record indicated last year. And it was also such a weird 60-game season. And then you have the new ownership. You have Francisco Lindor. You have Marcus Stroman back. You add Taijuan Walker. There were high expectations for the Mets this season. I mean, what's the difference between the Mets and the Yankees right now? It's 2 games in the loss column. But doesn't it feel like the Mets have been this great plucky team all season long? And for the Yankees, the sky has been falling all season long. And you look at the records, and the Mets are 51-44. And the Yankees are 51-46. And you ask yourself, all right, what are the differences between the Mets and the Yankees? Yeah, the Mets have better pitching. There's no question about that. And as good as Gerrit Cole has been, his last start notwithstanding, the Mets have the best pitcher in Major League Baseball on their staff. So you start there. But for me, it's simple. What the biggest difference between the Yankees and the Mets is the fact that the Yankees are playing in the same division as the Boston Red Sox and the Tampa Bay Rays, and the Mets aren't. So the Mets have been able to take their lumps. They've been able to withstand myriad injuries. They've been able to withstand slumps. An extremely disappointing season for their high-priced shortstop. All of that to remain in first place in the National League East. Why? Because the National League East is not nearly as good as the American League East. I mean, the Toronto Blue Jays, who are a half game behind the Yankees in the standings, might be the best team in the NL East. That's how deep the American League East is. So that's the difference right there. But we're not here to compare the Yankees and the Mets. The Mets have their own goals in mind. I think that both teams are in a unique spot because of the strength of the pitching at the top of their respective rotations, that if they get into the postseason field, either of these teams can do some damage. Now, getting into the postseason is going to be a lot easier for the Mets than it is for the Yankees, because the Yankees have to make up a 3.5 game deficit just to get a shot at the wild card game, which would likely be on the road against either Boston or Tampa Bay, whereas the Mets have a 4-game cushion in the National League East, and if they win the division, they can obviously bypass the wild card game. All right, here's Boone after yesterday's 4-3 comeback win, and if it was one of the most impressive comeback wins that he's seen for this Yankees team.
I think so. This, you know, this is a good one. And yeah, we've had, you know, more than our share of gut punches here in the last month or so. And to the guys' credit, as I've said, they keep getting off the mat and they keep fighting. Hasn't been easy. Hasn't been pretty, but we're in the fight. And we're going to continue to do that and hopefully come tomorrow and pull another one out.
Now, how about that eighth inning? You had base hit. Floreal starts it with a double. Gardner gets a big base hit. Stanton, the ground rule double. Rougned Odor, the single. Gleyber Torres, the single. How about that eighth inning and the resiliency that the team showed?
Yeah, I think so. I thought Flo had a great at bat to start it, you know, shooting it in the alley. Then Gardy, a really good I think it was a two-strike swing on the breaking ball that got him earlier in the game, put a really good swing on that to drive him in, you know. Then G dumps one out there, and Rugi goes the other way too. So just a great job of using the entire field. And, you know, in the blink of an eye, we, you know, had the lead by some real good, solid winning at bats there.
It's not the kind of rally, the few rallies the Yankees have had this year, it's not the kind of rally you're accustomed to seeing the Yankees have during this Aaron Boone / Brian Cashman era, especially the last 2 years, which have been so disappointing. It's not. The kind of rally the Yankees have would be a walk and then a two-run home run, or a walk, a double, and a three-run home run. And those are not as common as what you just saw. I mean, the Red Sox against the Yankees on Thursday night, single, single, double off the wall, sacrifice fly. You put the ball in play, more good things can happen. If you strike out, nothing good can happen. If you strike out, you walk back to the dugout and nothing happens. If you put the ball in play, sure, they might get you out. You might ground out. You might even ground into a double play if there's a runner on first base. But the law of averages, it's very simple. And this is why I don't understand the analytics guys pay attention to this. The law of averages would tell me that if you put the ball in play, it's more likely that a good outcome could happen than if you strike out. Obviously, if you hit a home run, it's better than any other outcome. We know that. But how infrequently do home runs occur? Not frequently enough to rely solely upon them. So a big eighth inning rally for the Yankees yesterday, and here's Boone on how big of a win this was.
Yeah, that's a good one. No question about it. You know, Evaldi was kind of held us down for a lot of the day, and then, you know, Flo gets us going there to start things off, and then some really competitive at bats followed, and you know, all of a sudden we got the lead there, and you know, J-Mo was terrific. You know, giving us seven strong innings, just keeping us in the game, keeping us around, and just really good to see the guys continue to fight and grind when it was, you know, it was a struggle, especially offensively, you know, the first several innings to mount much, and they just kept grinding away, and you know, credit to them for putting together a really good inning.
Ty, when you're listening to Boone give these interviews, do you feel like you need a dictionary or a thesaurus to try to figure out who he's talking about with all the nicknames?
So Rugi,
we got Flo, which to be clear is not the woman from the Progressive commercials. Is that right?
It's not.
Okay,
it's
good.
It's not the rapper Flo Rida either.
Right. Okay. We're assuming that's Estevan Floreal.
Yes.
I'm gonna go. Okay. Cool. J-Mo. Now you know I hear J-Mo.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a fun night out with my buddies.
Yes.
Belly up. J-Mo. We're gonna go with Jameson Taillon for that.
I would imagine that's who he's talking about as well.
Okay, cool. All right, thank. I'm glad we have that set up. I'm going to go with the J-Mo thing now. So J-Mo, and I mentioned his numbers earlier, he did a great job yesterday because not only does he give up the single runs in the first, second, and third innings, but two of them were unearned on two errors by Rougned Odor. He did a good job holding the Sox to one run in each of those innings, and he did an excellent job by holding them to three runs for the game. And again, this guy's got a 1.43 earned run average during the month of July. So, look, it's a small sample size. It's four starts. He was wildly inconsistent and mostly ineffective the first month and a half, 2 months of the season. But if you can get this kind of production out of Jameson Taillon. That could go a long way towards what they hope is this push towards the playoffs. So here's Boone on his starting pitcher yesterday.
He was great. He was pitch efficient. Just attacking the strike zone again, mixing his pitches. Obviously, it's a really good lineup, and the game potentially could have gotten away there in the middle innings, but he just kept pitching, kept making pitches, and you know, the important thing was he was so efficient, so he's able to kind of cruise through seven innings, really. Especially after they dinged him, you know, some hard contact early against him, but you know, I felt like he in a way got better as the game went along.
And Taillon's gotten better as the season has gone along. And look, this is, and it's so frustrating to say this, Ty, because it's a $200+ million payroll, but the Yankees right now are in survival mode where they just got to stay afloat against these tough teams like the Red Sox and the Rays. And here's the thing, and I hear people saying, oh, these are huge games because they have an opportunity to make up ground on them. Honestly, I think that went out the window with the first two losses of this series. You're eight games back of both Boston and Tampa Bay at this point in the season. I think it's highly unlikely that you're going to come back and win this division. So the Yankees' goal, to me, has to be the wild card, the second wild card. Now, I just laid out my scenario for why I think that there is a path for the Yankees to be successful in the postseason. If they get there, if the right players come back, and if they make the right move at the trade deadline, I think if they get into that postseason tournament, they can be successful. But knowing you as I do, Ty, I think you're going to throw cold water all over my argument.
Well, here's the thing, and you did an excellent job, you know, laying out the potential for the Yankees to make some kind of a run. But in your optimism, if we're looking at the fact that they did not strike out during a rally, doesn't that tell us something about this team?
Baby steps, man. Baby steps.
But we're taking baby steps in late July. Like, August is next week. We're talking about a team that was expected to not make the playoffs, not, you know, just win the division, but to contend for a World Series, and we're taking baby steps 2 months away from October?
I say yes only because you're not whole right now. And that goes back to being in survival mode. You know, you don't have Judge, you don't have Sanchez right now, you don't have Luke Voit, you don't have Corey Kluber. So I think there's two approaches this Yankees team has to take. When you're playing the top teams in the American League, and there's not a lot of them, you know, you got Boston, you got Tampa Bay, I think you're done with Houston. When you're playing those teams, just split. And the nice thing is, like I just said, I don't think you have to worry about trying to catch them or make up ground on them. And then when you're playing the dregs of the American League, the Orioles, the Rangers, the Twins, the Royals, the Tigers, those types of teams, that's where you've got to make your hay. That's where you've got to clean up and pick up ground in the standings. And that's the formula. And that's where the Yankees, that's the position they put themselves in right now.
Like, we're talking about survival mode. Even when this team was healthy, they were bad. They were a mediocre team when they were full, like prior to COVID, prior to all the injuries. They were still getting their doors blown off of them by the Red Sox and the Rays, you know, trailing these teams in both the wild card and the division. So why is it that I should expect anything differently even when they do come back?
Because you hope that Stanton's better at the end of the year. You hope that Judge is better at the end of the year. You hope that Sanchez is better at the end of the year. You hope that Luke Voit is better at the end of the year. Gleyber Torres appears to be better at the end of the year. You hope that DJ LeMahieu is better at the end of the year. Those are seven guys.
A lot of hope going on here.
I completely agree. And that's what's frustrating about this. Right? For $200+ million, one of the highest payrolls in baseball, you would like to hang your hopes, so to speak, on something more than hope. But unfortunately, because of all of the following, injuries, and more importantly, underperformance, that's the position they've put themselves in.
And but even to mention that the bullpen has become a question mark. Like, the strength of this team the last 4 years since they started this run was, at least we know if we hand a lead to our pen in the sixth inning, we are, you know, at a 90% clip going to win this game. And now all of a sudden, it's an experience. Even Chapman last night, you know, second and third, two outs, chance for the Red Sox to win the game. He got out of it with the strikeout, but you felt like the wheels were going to come off. And once again, we were going to have that, is this the worst loss of the season? So it just feels like, you know, every time the Yankees get on some type of a roll, they win a couple of games, and now we're confident again. They have Thursday night happen, or they have that Sunday afternoon in Houston happen, or the Met game happen, or the Angel game happen. Like, it just keeps on happening. So that becomes the expectation and not the aberration anymore.
Losing Loaisiga hurt. He came back yesterday, was a little shaky, but you got to give him some time to get back to full strength. You've got Zach Britton, who's been in and out, but he's been pretty good when he's been pitching. Chapman's numbers the last six games have been better. Chad Green, I think, has proven lately that he is not suited to be a closer, but I still think he's an effective setup man. So again, there's this H word. Hope that you hope all of those things can come together. Look, you're not hoping for, and again, I hate to keep picking on Greg Allen, because I like Greg Allen. I think he's been really good.
Greg Allen.
Since, I mean, he's been terrific, and he, in many ways, he's kind of helped save this season. But the numbers tell you that he's a 28-year-old journeyman. It's not like you're hoping for Greg Allen to continue playing this way for the rest of the season. You're actually hoping for guys who have some semblance of a major league track record to continue playing this way for the rest of the season. So I think that's the difference there.
Yeah,
I'll leave Greg Allen alone. Greg Allen's been really good for this team. I like him.
Poor Greg Allen. He didn't deserve what's happening to him this morning. Dude just, you know, waking up, getting ready for the game today.
Yeah.
Tunes into the radio station to hear good things about his team getting a big win last night.
And he's
night.
The example of why it can't be sustained. I don't know. I feel bad because I really like what he's brought to the team. I think he's made a huge difference. But again, you know, you at some point you wonder, can this continue for 2 months? I'm skeptical that it can. Look, it's a game by game, it's a day by day scenario for the Yankees right now. You got to win today, that would salvage a split of this 4-game series, and then you got to go down to Tampa Bay and you got to figure out a way to not lose that series. I mean, that's where we are. $200 million World Series favorites at the beginning of the season. Yankees, figure out a way to not lose series. Talk about the bar being lowered. My goodness. All right, you got Herman on the mound today. We'll see if he can continue that. Martin Perez pitching for the Boston Red Sox. We'll update you on Team USA against France in their first Olympic game.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Great stuff earlier in the hour by Tommy Beer of Forbes. Really did a good job laying out his case for the Knicks acquiring Damian Lillard this offseason. Now, a couple of things. Number one, he's got to become available, obviously. Number two, he's got to want to come to New York. Not 100% because technically Portland can trade him wherever they want to trade him. But generally when dealing with superstars on this level, it usually works out that they get to land in a spot where they want to go. One of the rare exceptions recently was Chris Paul 2 years ago when Houston traded him to Oklahoma City. But you got to remember, Chris Paul 2 years ago after that season in Houston was not Chris Paul, who he is right now. He was seen as the worst contract in the NBA. Now, he resurrected his career in Oklahoma City, and was subsequently traded where he wanted to go, which was Phoenix. So you have to factor that in as well. Now, Stephen A. Smith was a guest this week on the Michael Kay Show and gave his latest update on the Damian Lillard situation.
Well, I've known Damian Lillard for years, so let me just give it to you straight. It's very, very difficult for him to say that he wants to leave Portland. He is frustrated with management, but nevertheless, he loves playing for the organization, loves being in the city of Portland, and for the most part, really doesn't want to leave. However, if he were to decide to leave, he would want to come to the New York Knicks. Not the Lakers, not the Clippers, not Dallas, the New York Knicks, not Brooklyn. The New York Knicks would be his number one choice if he were to decide that he wanted out of Portland.
And look, the NBA draft is this Thursday. So if there is a Lillard trade, you've got to think there's a better than average chance that something would happen before the draft, because draft picks would be involved in any trade that is made. Complicating things, of course, is the fact that Lillard himself right now is in Tokyo playing for Team USA, which lost, by the way, earlier today to France, 83-76. Here's more from Stephen A. with Michael Kay on the Damian Lillard situation.
the New York market, along with the fact that he believes that he would be able to get people to come and want to play with him. His problem is that nobody wants to come to the Pacific Northwest, really. He doesn't believe that would be the case in a New York Knicks uniform. His mentality, just how he's built, he's the kind of guy that he doesn't want to join a super team. He doesn't want to join forces. He doesn't mind being the one responsible for putting it together, because that's entirely different if dudes wanted to come and play with him. He's not a follower, and he's not the kind of guy that wants it to join KD and James Harden or LeBron and AD in LA or Kawhi and Paul George with the Clippers. He's not built like that. He wants to be that guy. If you want to come and play with him, fine. But he's not built like I want to go and piggyback on other guys in order to be successful. It's just the way that he's built. It's his mentality. And he's never changed in all the years that I've known.
Now, last Friday, Lillard gave a press conference in Las Vegas before Team USA departed for the Olympics in Tokyo, and was very, very honest. He spoke for about 9 minutes in his press conference about the situation in Portland. And in no uncertain terms, he was not ambiguous at all. Damian Lillard let it be known that he is not happy with the current situation. Now, you can look, the average person can look at the Trailblazers situation since Lillard got there and say, what a great situation it's been. Terry Stotts was there, I think, for 8 years, all of them with Lillard. They've gone to the playoffs every single year. They've gone past the first round a couple of times. They went to the Western Conference Finals in 2019 and were swept there by the Golden State Warriors. I think 18 to 20 NBA teams in a second would sign up for that level of success over an 8-year period, including the team that plays in Madison Square Garden. Now, they're hoping to start a stretch just like that. And obviously, if they could acquire Damian Lillard, that would certainly help. But Lillard made it be known that that's not good enough. He acknowledged, yeah, this is what we've done. The fan base is great. The organization is great. We go to the playoffs every year. Occasionally, we win a round. He was despondent over Portland's first-round playoff loss this season. He continually referred to the fact that his Trailblazers, which were at full strength for the most part, lost to a Denver Nuggets team that was missing its second-best player, its point guard, Jamal Murray. And Lillard continues to lament that fact. And the implication is, how are things going to get better from here? Portland is not a team that has a lot of moves to make unless they trade their second best player, CJ McCollum. But what does that get you? If you trade CJ McCollum, he's obviously their one big trade chip if you want to hold on to Damian Lillard. If you trade CJ McCollum, how much better are you getting? Now, McCollum and Lillard, like I said, have done a very nice job bringing Portland to the playoffs every single year. But Lillard's 31 years old. He's probably one of the 10 best players in the NBA. And you look around at all of the other top 10 players in the NBA, and most of them have won championships or been to the NBA Finals or consistently at least been to conference finals. Lillard's been to the conference finals once. I mean, who are the 10 best players in the NBA? Well, let's start naming them off. LeBron James, he's got a bunch of championships. Giannis Antetokounmpo, he just won the NBA championship. Kevin Durant, he's got championships. Stephen Curry, the player with whom Lillard is most often compared, he's got a handful of championships. James Harden has played in the finals. He's played in conference finals. So even Chris Paul now, you can add his name to the list of guys that have gotten to the NBA Finals. Lillard recognizes that his window is starting to close at the age of 31. I think he can give you four excellent seasons, whoever he ends up playing for, whether it's Portland this year, whether it's New York, whether it's another team. Tommy Beer did a really nice job for us laying out. I asked him, I said, what is a reasonable price to pay if you're the Knicks for acquiring Damian Lillard and RJ Barrett? You got to start there. Emmanuel Quickley, Mitchell Robinson, and let's say what, three first round draft picks and two or three pick swaps with Portland. Is that enough to get it done? I don't know, but I think that gets you close anyway. That gets you in the conversation with Portland. But there's a couple of important things to keep in mind. Number one, the fact that the Knicks are even in this position that I agree with Stephen A. Smith, and he obviously has more insight into Damian Lillard than I do, but I agree with him in that I see no reason why Damian Lillard or any superstar who wants out of his current situation wouldn't want to come to play for the Knicks. They're a playoff team right now. They play in the biggest market which is important for a guy like Damian Lillard, who has spent his career in Portland. The fan base was completely re-energized this past season. And if you come to New York, even though you'd have to give up those picks, and even though you'd have to give up those young players like a Barrett and a Quickley and a Mitchell Robinson, you're still coming to play alongside an unselfish second-team All-NBA player in Julius Randle, and you still have other first-round draft picks at your disposal because of the Kristaps Porzingis trade and other moves that management has made in recent years to stockpile assets. This is the first time in a long time that the Knicks have even been in this position to make a move like this. It's going to be very interesting to see how far down the road they go, if they end up, if given the opportunity, pulling the trigger on a move like this, because that could and would change everything.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.
Getting some reaction on the phones, which we'll get to momentarily, but never at a loss for words, especially when it comes to defending his guy, Kevin Durant. Ty Butler, our excellent producer, wanted to hop in to defend his guy on what I said a moment ago.
So we impugn Durant's leadership and the alpha male, or lack thereof. Is that the reason why Dame Lillard today shot 3 of 10 from the field?
No.
Is that the reason why Tatum was 3 of 9, or Devin Booker was 1 of 6, and Drew Holiday, who kept them in it but ended up shooting 5 of 13? That's not the reason why they lost the game today. Offensively, they've
well, hold on. There's one stat line you left out there, by the way. And you left out left out Durant's 1%.
He also struggled, yes. But my point is, like, the other guys in the team collectively struggling isn't because he's not a leader. It's not because he's not an alpha male. They've got to shoot better. They've got to play better. They've been inconsistent. And we're not going to use the excuses of, you know, them not having enough time to get this is the best collection of talent that should be existing in the pool. They should be able to win these games. But this idea that, you know, he wasn't the man in Golden State. Yes, he was. We know Durant was the best player on that team. He won the two finals MVPs. Both the biggest shots in the consecutive finals in 17 and 18 was hit by Kevin Durant. He was the best player on that team. Draymond was the emotional leader. You know, Steph Curry was more loved because of what he means to the city, what he means to that organization. But
and
Durant
because
the
he's the greatest three-point shooter of all time.
Yes,
also.
But Durant was the better player, and I don't think that's arguable. The reason why the Nets lost this year to the Bucks, was it because Durant wasn't a leader? Was it because he wasn't an alpha male? Or was it that Kyrie Irving got hurt and James Harden was playing on one leg? And, you know, if those guys were healthy, they would have beaten the Bucks in 5 and won the championship. So I just think that sometimes we go too far in our criticism of Durant because we lament what happened in 2016 when he left Oklahoma City. And
but
went
that's
to the
part
team.
Of his story. And
I get it.
By making that decision, he opens himself up for the conversations and the criticism that comes his way. And look, the facts are facts. And I think he showed himself to be an alpha male in the Milwaukee Bucks series. Like I said, he almost single-handedly, you know, because Kyrie was out and James Harden was playing at 40 or 50% with his hamstring, Durant almost single-handedly beat the team that eventually won the NBA championship. Yeah. So he definitely, but the facts are this, right? Has he ever gone to a finals playing alongside fewer than two future Hall of Famers? The answer is no, he hasn't.
Well, and let's just look
it's
at
very easy to be. Sorry, let me real quick. Let me just say this. I wanted to respond to what you said earlier. It's easy to be the best player on the Golden State Warriors when you're playing with Curry and Thompson and Draymond Green. It's with his talent. That was the softest landing spot he could have found, and he hunted it out and he found it.
So you were there, Game 7 at the Barclays Center.
Yeah, against the Bucks.
You watched with 50 seconds left remaining in that overtime period. Joe Harris had as wide open of
in the corner.
A three that anyone can have. Pat O'Keefe could have hit in that shot.
Actually pretty good from the
could
corner.
Could have hit that shot.
It's 40% in high school.
He could have hit that shot. If Joe Harris makes any, you know, if he looks anything like the player he was in the regular season, the Nets go on to win the series. They go on to win the title. And I think the conversation about Durant is different just because of how they got there. And I think that, to me, is forever going to haunt him. Like, when Kyrie and Harden return next year healthy and they win the championship, people are still going to say the same thing, super team. Whereas if they had won this year with those guys being compromised, we look at him differently. History remembers him as someone of, you know, not just winning championships with great players, but how he carried this team, you know, despite not having his two best players. But as far as, like, I get it. If you want to criticize him for the Golden State thing, I understand it. But are we going to allow that to, you know, to judge how we view him as far as his overall abilities and his talent and you know, him being a winner? Like, we're just unfair in how we talk about Durant.
I think people view his overall abilities and his talent pretty favorably. I think you'll look at him and say he's a top 15, top 20 player of all time. I mean, is he LeBron James? No. Is he Kobe Bryant? No. And that's okay. Hardly anybody was. The fact that he's even in the discussion to be compared with those guys says a lot about how talented he is. I can't get past the 2016 thing. When you do what he did, you open the door to be criticized or critiqued or whatever word you want to put on it for the rest of your career. And yeah, if Joe Harris hits the shot, we view him differently.
But it's not like he went to Golden State and became Sean Livingston. Like, coming off the bench, giving them 12 minutes and 3 points.
No.
He went there, became their best player. Won them championships.
How easy would it be to be? It's for somebody of his talent, it's so easy to be the best player on that team.
It's easier, but here's what I know.
Easiest.
What I know is that the series before he got there, the last playoff series that Warriors team played prior to Kevin Durant, we saw them blow a 3-1 lead to LeBron James in the finals. The series after he got hurt in that series against the Raptors, they lose. They went 8-1 with him in the finals when he was healthy. They lost the surrounding series without
him. I still
him.
Think they would have beaten the Raptors if Klay Thompson didn't tear his ACL.
I mean, you could argue that, but what we know is if Durant doesn't get hurt, they win the series.
Agreed.
And when he was healthy, they
he
were
He was impressive in those
finals.
12 minutes when he came back before he tore
did.
The I'll
and
tell you that.
Clearly compromised.
And I'll give him credit for rushing back. Look, he's not creditless, in my opinion, throughout his career, but there are certain things that you can pick at, and he's left himself susceptible to that because of decisions that he's made.
I just thought that after that Bucks series, what he was able to do with the 49-point triple-double in Game 5, you know, him being fantastic in Game 7 without Kyrie and with Harden on one leg, essentially, I thought that the narrative would change, but you still have people out here disrespecting him. And I just think it's a little unfair. I get it. You can chastise
Pat O'Keefe.
Him for the
Pat O'Keefe, nice to meet you.
I you can chastise him for what happened in Oklahoma City, blowing the 3-1 lead and then joining the Warriors. I get it. But
no showing in the fourth quarter of Game 7?
No showing in the fourth. I mean, he played every
second
of the
game. I'm talking about when he was with OKC.
Oh, in OKC.
When they
yeah.
blew it to the Warriors. No showing.
No showing
in the fourth quarter.
He was bad in the fourth quarter. Russell Westbrook, they were both bad in those three, you know, games 5 through 7. I get it. But I just think, again, sometimes we go a little too far in how critical we are of one of the greatest players we've ever seen.
I can agree with that. He's one of the greatest players we've ever seen. I also agree with me. Let's take some more calls. Let's go to Fran in Massapequa. Hey, Fran, what's going on?
What's up, bro? How you doing? I agree with Ty. Durant's an animal. He's off the hook good, and he's unbelievable. So I just think he's an absolutely stunningly good player, and whatever it is, it's just my opinion. But the reason they lost is very simple. He said they were up by 8, correct?
You're talking about today? You're talking about the U.S. today?
Yeah, today they were up by 8.5, right?
Yep.
The USA team was up by 8.5 and up by 13 in the fourth quarter. There's only one person to blame for this, and nobody ever gets on this guy.
Popovich?
And that's the coach, Popovich.
Yeah. Yeah.
No one ever gets on this guy. This guy can say whatever he wants to any person. He can rip someone to shreds. No one ever says a word bad about this guy. Well, let me tell you something. I think he's a first-class creep. I don't like him. I don't like anything he stands for. I think I would never want to play for a guy like him. He got on that reporter a week ago, 10 days ago. No one said a word about it, maybe a couple of people. He's the reason they lost today. You blame the coach. The talent is there. It's what he does with it. That's the bottom line. His team failed. The coach's team failed. They choked in the fourth quarter. That's because of the coach. He didn't make the right assignments. He didn't make the right check the right changes. He's a bum. I can't stand that guy. And he just gets way too much credit, and he never gets any blame, never gets talked about when he rips people to shreds, especially in this new era that we live in. He has no respect for people sometimes, and it's an absolute joke.
Fran, thanks for the call. I don't disagree with everything you're saying either. Look, I think regarding this particular game, the blame has to be spread across the board. And Greg Popovich certainly deserves his fair share of it. But when Evan Fournier hits a three to give France a 76-74 lead in the final minute, and Durant has a three and misses, and you get an offensive rebound, and LaVine misses a three, and you get an offensive rebound, and then Durant misses a three, and you get an offensive rebound, and then Drew Holiday misses a three. That's not the coach's fault. That's not. There are other aspects of the game where he should have tightened things up, and this team in its current construction has been rocky since the beginning, and blame for that has to be placed at the feet of Greg Popovich. I mean, before they had the COVID issues that knocked Bradley Beal out, and before Jeremy Grant went down with COVID-19, and before Kevin Love abandoned the team, you still lost to Nigeria. And I know you can say it's an exhibition game, but you lost to Nigeria. I mean, give me a break. And then you back that up. How do you respond? You lost to Australia. So both of those things have to fall at the feet to a certain extent of the head coach. But Popovich has won five NBA championships. In 2014, he beat his Spurs team beat the super team Miami Heat and ran them off the floor in those NBA finals. Now, is the bloom off the rose with Popovich late in his career? I think it is. The Spurs have missed the playoffs the last 2 years. They lost Kawhi Leonard. The roster does not have as much talent. Like any great coach, including Bill Belichick last season, if your talent isn't as good, your team isn't as good. So yeah, I think Popovich is coming to the end of a very storied and successful career. But you can't take those five NBA championships away from him. Let's go to Brian in Manhattan. What's up, Brian?
Hey, how are you? I was going to talk about KD, but I can't let that last call get away with what he obviously doesn't like Popovich because of his progressive leaning.
He never mentioned that. He didn't mention anything about politics, Brian.
Excuse me. That's why he doesn't like Popovich. Okay.
How do you know? How do you know that's why he doesn't like Popovich? He never mentioned anything about politics or progressiveness. He didn't mention anything. He mentioned how he treats people.
He just lies. Like, the idea of the reporter.
Who lies? Popovich lies?
No. Your last caller claimed that Popovich was awful to a reporter.
Popovich has been awful to reporters. That's true.
Excuse me. I'm the one calling. Please let me talk. Did you see that interview? Did you listen to that interview? He did not insult the reporter. Was he super nice? No. He's never been nice. But he's a great coach. And honestly, the NBA player of today, it's hard enough coaching an NBA team for a full season. Having a bunch of stars that are all shot-driven, this team is terribly put together. It's just a bunch of three-point shooters like Zach LaVine, Kevin Durant, Dame Lillard. They're all fine individual players, but there's no cohesion. That's not on Popovich, right? I mean, honestly, I'm surprised they picked him because it's an impossible job, and maybe they did it as a meritorium thing, but it's not on Popovich that this team has no teamwork. They were poorly designed. And as it relates to Kevin Durant won nothing until he went to the Warriors. Kevin Durant is individually one of the best players to ever play the game. But the only chance for a championship for him was when he picked his opponents, Warriors, to join, and when he came with Kyrie to the Nets. Those are facts. It doesn't take away from the fact that he's a tremendous individual player. But he's not being disrespected. These are honest feelings. People don't think that. Both fans don't think you should get to choose to play on the best team to make them better. It just doesn't make sense.
I agree with your point on Kevin Durant, Brian, and thanks for the call. I mean, look, the Popovich thing is, Popovich has been rude to reporters. He's deserving of criticism here. And to say that a head coach isn't responsible for the cohesion of the team is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard a caller say in my entire life. So thank you for pointing out that you were the caller, and you followed that up by saying one of the most absurd things I've ever heard in my entire life. So thank you for the call.
You're listening to Anita Marks on 98.7 ESPN.